To give you the stats right away, I've been sober 23 years. I'm 50 years old. I got both those numbers one day at a time. I have a home group. It's the Saturday Beginners Big Book Meeting, which meets Saturday mornings at St. George's Church. I've been a member of that group since it started 14 years ago, after 14th Street Workshop closed. I also attend the Sunday morning meditation meeting at St. George's. Now it's moved to where PAX is in Manhattan. That's another story. And also a member of the city group morning meetings. And I'm grateful to be here. I sponsor 11 men and women, and I'm grateful for that because they tend to call me when I don't want to be bothered. And I have to answer the call because I see the name, and it's like, oh, God, help me. And then all of a sudden, when I get off the phone 5 minutes later, it's like, what was the problem? It was me. It's always me. I'm always the problem. I was lucky I had a sponsor. He was much different from me. He was late Bob Billheimer. And one of the things he asked me to do, I was in art school at the time, he asked me to make a sign. And I was a graphic design major, and he said, "The sign, write this up, print this on the sign out, and put, 'You're looking at the problem.'" And I made it for him, and I brought it to him. I was like, "Look at the sign; it's beautiful." And he says, "That's not for me. That's for you to put on your mirror." And so every morning when I got up, looked at myself, to brush my teeth, "You're looking at the problem." And a couple months later, when I was doing my fourth step, I went to his house, and I walked into his bathroom. He had a sign on his mirror. And it didn't say, "You're looking at the problem." It says, "You are important." And I got very annoyed at that. And I came back into the room and I was like, "So I'm a problem and you're important." And he just looked at me with these eyes. And he just said, "No, that sign was for you." Because he had to show me that the fourth step was friendly. And all of a sudden, all those things that I thought about myself, or that I thought I was a useless piece of garbage, and no one loved me, and I was unlovable, was not true. But I was important, because when I was doing the fourth step, I never thought I possible to see any good qualities in me. All I saw was bad, bad, bad. One of the exercises he asked me to do was to go out. Well, it tells us, you know, in we agnostics about, you know, if we only think what that man has and think the way he does. He asked me to put a list of 10 guys who I wanted what they had. And I wrote guys like Tom H. and there's Terry F. Some of these guys are still around. Some other guys are not around anymore, unfortunately. And there were qualities about them that I saw that I actually wanted. And I brought him the list and I said, "I want to be like this. I like this quality about this guy. This guy does service. This guy wears, you know, life like a loose garment. This guy is just funny. This guy has a great relationship with his wife. This guy's successful." And he says, "Well, you can have that." And I was like, "How can I have that?" And he says, "Well, you're going to go to each one of those guys and ask them how they did it." And I went to every single of those guys and they told me how they did it. And I had to do those things. And that was incentive for me for 6 and 7 to go forward. These are the things I need to work for. The same signed idea of what we do in the sex inventory, it's not what I can get out of a relationship, what I can bring to it. I can be the man. I am the man that my cat thinks I am. That's what I have become today. I'm loving and my cat loves me unconditionally. But also that exercise taught me how to do 8 and 9 because it taught me how to make appointments and also approach people, tell them something, and sit there and shut up and listen and hear them. The greatest problem I have, you know, is staying out of my own way, to go back to the topic, you know, which you guys were discussing. A lot of things crossed my mind. And Harry Thiebaud, you know, one of our great help, you know, guys who were there for us, psychologists, and he just talked about how the ego rebuilds itself. We come in here, we're so beaten, we ask for help. And then what happens after we eat a couple months, we start looking good and feeling good, and all of a sudden we know. I know what to do. And I remember calling Bob once, and I said, "Bob, I am so angry, and I don't know why." And he would say, "If you don't know why you're angry, why stay angry?" It never occurred to me. I didn't have to be angry. Never dawned on me. And then he would follow up and says, "I don't know is a wonderful place to be." I was like, "Oh, great, I got the Riddler as a sponsor. What the hell is he talking about?" And he, you know, I didn't have the guts to ask him. But years later, I understood. I am dangerous to myself and other people when I know. I don't know is a wonderful place to be. When I say it a God's way and other people's way, and people come to embrace me and ask for help, but can I go to people and ask them for help when I needed help? Today I had something going on with me the past couple days, and I had to ask for help, and people reached out. And they asked me, "How are you doing? What's going on?" And I told them. And they were like, "You know, I'm there for you." A couple days ago, you know, I've had health problems with my sobriety, you know, different things. And the other day, the doctor called me. He says, "You got to come in here right away." My red blood count was sky high. And what it could do is cause a stroke. And Since I'm not a kid anymore, he's like, you have to come in, you have to get this blood work done, and you have to go to the doctor, you might have to take this medication. So I was sitting at work today all by myself, and I'm usually busy, and when I'm busy at work, I'm fine. It was so quiet. There was no one around either. I was there by myself. And my helpful friend was talking to me. He was just like, give me all this great information I can live by. And one of the thoughts was, you know, the cleaning lady's going to find you Monday morning dead on your desk. You know, it's just like, where does this stuff come from? It's like, I should write this down. You know, there might be a good comedy here. And all of a sudden, just out of the blue, someone texted me, and I told them what was going on, and they laughed at me. You know, it's like, you're so funny. You know, and then a sponsee texted me, and was like, can I go to the meeting with you? So I just stay out of the way, and I'm okay. I'm taken care of. my sponsor always gave me books, and I'm, you know, talking about 10, 11, 12, a couple of people touched on. And, you know, I've done the steps several times. I actually hear them more from other people, which is a great thing. I'm always constantly, I do a written 10 step every day. I practice prayer and meditation every day. I sit quietly, dedicate time to God, and do the 12th step by doing service, not just in AA, but also out there. And on my 10th step, there's always three kind acts I have to do every single day for the other person, for someone I don't know. And I can't tell no one about it. It's for them. But one of the books I got was from Joel Goldsmith, and it was the Altitude Prayer. And he described an appliance. For an appliance to work properly, it has to find a power source. We have to find a power source who we can live by. And it has to be plugged into it. But once you turn the switch on, when you unplug it, it has to be maintained and cleaned regularly, 10 step. I have to clean out all that stuff for that appliance to work properly. And there's God. And when I bring God into the equation, instead of going to the meditation and seeing what I can get out of it, what can I bring into the meditation? And in step 12, I can be a service of other people. There are two presences in my life. There's the healing presence, which is full of AA, God, and all of you, in my heart. And then there's the judgmental presence. My former self, my mother, my stepfather, everyone in my life who's ever criticized me. Two different presences, two set of voices. And which one do I want to live in? I want to be in the balance somehow. Happy. I don't want to be overly happy because I'm afraid I'm going to lose it. I don't want to be too depressed because I don't want anyone to see me depressed because I don't want to be on the pity pot and people say, what's wrong with you now? No, I want to be balanced, okay. And in this presence here, a best example of what my heart can tell me and listening to my heart, I'm a photographer, and I did this study out on Staten Island of these old junkyard, an old ship graveyard. And there were these boats all made out of wood and steel and iron. They were beautiful. And they just sat in this water for 50 or 60 years. And they slowly decayed into this water. And I showed these pictures to some people, and you know, their response is, why are you taking pictures of junk? Can't you take, you know, some nicer things? You know? And that's one set of voices there. Where is the God in their lives? And then one of my sponsees said to me, that is amazing. Look at the colors of this. All this stuff we took from the earth, used these boats, man used them for years, we retired them, and Mother Earth has taken them back. Two set of voices. Where do I want? Where's my presence? And it's the godly presence. And I didn't have that until I came here. I didn't have anybody. Well, all I had was just despair, pain, misery, suffering, and all of it was because of me. I grew up in some of the most beautiful places in the world, and I did not want to be there. Imagine growing up in the Sierras in California, and you hated it there. Out on the California coast, you hated it there. Staten Island, I won't even get into that. I grew up there too, but I'll leave that one alone. But I could not appreciate because I was not comfortable in my own skin. I didn't like anything. I grew up around alcoholics. Both my parents were alcoholics. Both my step-parents were alcoholics. That's all I knew. My father was one of 12 kids. Of the 8 brothers, all of them are dead, including himself from alcoholism. One brother was shot by his own son. That's what alcohol will do to us. It'll kill us one way or another. And I grew up knowing the facts that I can't drink safely. I'll end up like these other guys, but I took a drink anyway. And what alcohol did was that sense of relief. It took away that gigantic emptiness, the void in my chest, the fear, the anxiety, the terror, and the voices in my head telling me I'm no good. It removed that. And it worked for about a week, maybe a month. And then it just turned on me. At the age of 16, it was fun drinking because there was no punishment. It was just like, I'll go out, I'll go drinking, and I can wake up the next morning and go to work. But that didn't last too long. And eventually it just turned on me, and I found myself just filled with just terror once again. Thank you. And, you know, for years, you know, I lived on Staten Island. I was doing construction work. I made a lot of money. Imagine being a 19-year-old, 20-year-old kid getting paid $2,000 on a Friday, and Monday morning there's no money left. I did that every week for years and years. I worked with a bunch of Norwegian guys, and they were like, you know, you're a great worker. Tuesday to Friday on 12 o'clock, that's it. After that, all bets were off. As soon as you put a drink in front of me, I was gone. And I did that for week in, week in, for years and years. I tried everything to stop drinking except to stop drinking. I thought if I did this differently or did this differently, it didn't work. Nothing seemed to work. I just was not comfortable in my hide, and I could not ask for help. I had no use for people. I had no use for you. I couldn't ask for help. Reason why is because it's just my relationship. My mother left me on a street corner when I was 14 years old, handed me $100, and told me she didn't want me in her life because I interfered with her drinking. So I couldn't go to anybody. I didn't know how to turn to people because people at least let me down. I couldn't ask for help. I had to learn that here all over again. I had to be retrained in Alcoholics Anonymous. I couldn't, you know, ask for anyone. But what happened was just the drinking escalated, the drug use escalated, and I just found myself just absolutely out of control. I couldn't stop. I didn't know how to stop. People pointed out my drinking. And throughout my training, I always said I would stop if this happened. Like, you know, fight with a girlfriend, we break up, happened, kept on drinking. I'd be like, thank God she's gone. I get in a car accident, big deal. I'll just scrape off the stickers and take off the license plate and leave it. That's happened. You know, I get arrested. And then all of a sudden I get a DAT, a disappearance ticket, and, you know, we're doing it again. All those things, I would stop. And I did over and over again. I was totally insane because once at a job site, I fell down a stairwell, two flights, and I fell down onto a pile of ice. I landed on my back with a hammer in my back and a measuring tape. And then I slid down about 8 feet into a wall that had studs on it with nails out of it, and that was a bloody mess. And two guys took me to the hospital, and they just left me there. That's the type of friends I had then. And they came back later, they were wasted, and they were like, when are you going to be done? Like, you know, like, I can't move, dudes. But they scored, you know, somehow. And I wanted to party with them. And I managed to get my pants on and my shoes on and crawl my hands and knees to get out to the truck to smoke with them and drink with them. Bone dry. That's insanity, folks. It's not what I do when I take the drink. It's what happens after it. The insane thinking. The whiskey and the milk. Anything that's italic in the big book, watch out for it. Those warnings there. And that was me. But eventually what happened was just like all those things started happening, the rest, the losing things, and on and on. And it was a guy I worked with named Bebo. Bebo was a construction worker. He looked like Charles Manson. He had a glass eye. He lost his glass eye in a bar fight to his wife. He was just really a loser. And I was just like, if I end up like him, I will stop drinking. And all those things happened. I went to California thinking that New York was my problem. I was in California for about 10 minutes, and I was already doing what I was doing here. And I got sober in the seat of my pants after being arrested. 70-something days in a detox and outpatient rehab. And people said, we'll take you to AA meetings. We'll pick you up because, you know, they had to drive you. It wasn't like here where we can just walk to a meeting or take a train. You know, people had to drive you. And I was like, no, I'm going to still do it my way. I was living with my mother and stepfather, the people who abandoned me 10 years earlier. And they were popping pills and drinking vodka like it was out of style. This was my support network. And one day my stepfather came out with a can of beer, and he said, your problem is the booze. Not the booze, it's the drugs. If you learn to control your drinking like me, you'll be okay. That's why you should never do a 12-step call on your own, because his disease reached out to mine. And I took a sip of that can of beer, and it was like I never stopped. And what brought on was the worst 8 months of my life. I came back to New York because after that day, I was off to the races. I was stealing anything. I would rob you blind. I would rob anyone blind. I had no regard for your feelings. I didn't have feelings. And I was living on the streets of Bay Ridge, Brooklyn. I was probably about 180 pounds. I weigh 215 now. I couldn't wear a short-sleeved shirt. The only thing that mattered was where the next one was coming from. Booze, drugs, whatever. And it didn't matter how I got it. If I panhandled on a train or on the streets, or I went to Catholic Charities and asked them for tokens or whatever, and vouchers, and I would cash them in. And I'd go into the church, and I would con the priest, or I would just rob the poor box. I didn't care. I had no regard for God or anything like that. And I did that for months and months and months. One day I saw one of these nice church ladies in the church, and she was always good for $5. And I went up to her to run a con on her, but she ran a con on me. But you know, at that point, my drinking, when I passed out, I had hoped God would kill me in my sleep. And God heard my prayers. And he killed that old person. You know, we hear in 6 and 7, to die daily. Daily dying, you know. Out of the Bible, John. I can't remember the actual mark. But the old me had to die for the new one to live. And this woman invited me to her house, and I came in to eat. Only went there to get a couple bucks. And she had her brother there. He had been sober and Alcoholics Anonymous for 16 years. And I tried to run one of my cons on him, and he just looked at me and said, I've heard it before, because I've done it before. No, you're not getting it. And he said a lot of things to me, and I knew it was one of you AA cold people, and my radar went up. And he said, you know, you don't have to drink today. Really? I don't have to drink today? I was physically hooked on the drug alcohol. I had to drink. And he took me up to Graymore thinking that was the place for me. And Graymore wouldn't even take me. They were afraid I was going to have a seizure up there and die. And so I came back to Brooklyn. I called this guy because I was desperate. And he came and picked me up in a car with three other guys. And they got me in the back seat. And these guys were delighted to be going to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I hated them because they were laughing. And they would drive to the meeting and get there an hour before the meeting. And I'm like, what are we here for? And they're here. We're like, oh, we're here to do ABCs, ashtrays, brooms, and chairs. And they would set up the chairs, and they hand me a stack of ashtrays. And I'm like, what am I supposed to do with these? And they're like, well, put them on every other seat, except for those 6 seats over there. That's a non-smoking section. Don't put them over there, please. And I sat in the back, and someone told me to shut up and come up here, sit in the front, told me to shut up and listen, take the cotton out of my ears and stick it in my mouth. I didn't know anything how to stay sober. That was my first resentment in Alcoholics Anonymous. I still see the guy's face today. And after the meeting, there was a break, and I didn't want to go back in the car with these guys. I stayed for the second meeting, and I found the guy who I knew was a sucker. And I needed a couple bucks to go score. And he was like, what do you want the money for? And I was like, I want to get a couple slices of pizza. And he said, hold on. And I waited, and another meeting started, and I waited because I was desperate. And he's like, you ready? And I was like, I thought this guy was going to actually take me out for pizza. And said there was 12 of you, took me to the diner and put me in one of those circular booths and stuck me in the middle. And they were all listening to me, and they were all smiling and doing that bobblehead thing. You know, it's just like, I was keeping everyone sober that night. And I was like, I needed my family, I need a car, I need this, this. And someone said, well, no, BS, what you need to learn how to do is to stay away from the first drink. And that's what I needed to do. And I went to meetings with these people, and I had a seizure outside the meeting. I woke up, and I was bit my tongue, and because I was withdrawn from alcohol and pills. And someone arranged, who I never met, the kindness of other people. They just arranged for me going to this place out on Staten Island, the last place I wanted to be. And I had to be in there for a couple of weeks. They arranged for me to go into a therapeutic community on the Lower East Side. But I had to stay there for a couple of weeks and be detoxed first. And they cut me loose early, and then all of a sudden I was being brought down by the counselor who was giving my, this is what you're going to do, this is what you have to report. And I had 4 days I have to wait before going in there. I was terrified. And she said, why don't you go into the meeting, and that's starting right now. And I walked into that meeting, and the guy with the glass eye, he was in the meeting. And all of a sudden they introduced the speaker, it was him. And then finally, the first time in my life, I actually did what I was told when I was in detox and rehab. I asked for help. And I said, I just got out of detox, and people applauded. People came over, gave me their cards. People gave me their numbers. And people gave me tokens and cigarettes. No one gave me money. And these people took me home and made sure I got to this place a couple of days later. There's no other kind of kindness. A total stranger, you know, who was robbing people on the streets one day, all of a sudden, he was like, no, come home with us. It's like, don't you know who I am? Come home with us. And they made sure I got there. And when I got there, they said, okay, you know, I was already drug-free. They were like, you can go to meetings. And they sent me out to Live In Now when it was on St. Mark's Place. It was much different then. It wasn't like what I see around here, a lot of young people. I was 26 years old. There was no young people. And then someone said, why don't you go to 14th Street Workshop? It was a new meeting. And people were, you know, alcoholics and addicts. And it was a new meeting, and it was meetings all day long. And that's what I did. And then one of these guys said, you know, you should come on a retreat with us. And I went on a retreat with these guys. And then one guy asked me, what do you want to do for a living? I told him. And he said, why don't you come to my studio? He owned a pain and restoration studio. And he put me to work. And then I met another guy. And he was like, when I was at 14th Street, they always had signs above the doors there for each meeting because of the multiple meetings. Someone said, do you have nice penmanship? Can you make these signs? I did. And he said, you should go to school for that. Then I met somebody else who was like, you know, you should really go to art school and help me put a portfolio together. And then someone helped me fill out the financial aid papers. And next thing I know, I went to the school with a portfolio. They looked at it and they were like, this stuff is great. There was one illustration I did of me with my head exploding because it was the time when I was doing my first fort step. You know, they were like, tell us about this. And I was like, I don't really want to, but and I have it someplace. And, you know, but people were there for me. They showed me how to do things. You know, this is how we do it. We can help you because you're going to help somebody else with this one day. And I got accepted by that school. I went to that school. I hated it in the beginning because everyone was much younger than me. And finally, I was like, I give up. And I turned to Bob and said, I can't do this. And he said, why don't you use what you learned in A and put it used to school? And what I did was I came early, I stayed late, I sat in the front, I did the homework, I did the required reading. I exchanged phone numbers, I stayed afterwards and asked the teacher questions if I didn't understand anything. And if I didn't do the homework, I showed up no matter what. You know, go to school for God, not for man. That's what I had to do. And now I go to work for God, not for man. And what happened is 4 years later, I graduated at the top of my class with outstanding honors. And here I was in Avery Fisher Hall on stage with a couple of people getting this award. And I was like, oh, if you only knew who I was, you know. And I got recruited by a company in there. And they hired me. They met me. They loved my stuff. They hired me. And I've been doing that stuff for the last 17 years. And it's just an amazing adventure. And no matter what happens, we do not give ourselves permission to drink. There are some bad things that will happen to us, health things, relationships thing, that sponsor that I love so much. I saw him die about 7 years, and I was in the hospital every day trying to feed him. And I watched him walk away, this man who has so much love and gave me so much love. And it was just beautiful to be there, you know, just when he passed, you know, and just heartbreaking. But then he lives in me still. And he lives in the guys I work with. Most of them, they say, I feel like I know him. And they do. If you know Kevin Heaney, Kevin Heaney was also one of his guys too. So there's a whole message. There's a whole flock of us who still carry the message. And the message was brought to him by Phil Ford, who was his sponsor. So I know these. And it's just going generation to generation. And all it is God is love. And it's the love I have. It's not what I think I have. It's what I know I can give. And it's an amazing life I have today. I've been fortunate to see some things that people should never see. And I've seen some things that you all should see. Last year, be careful what you ask for. I went to Africa for a couple of weeks. I went to Namibia with a sober buddy. And here, him and I are sitting by a waterhole all day long. Two drunks between us with 50 years of sobriety, 55 years of sobriety. Sitting there all day long in 110 degree heat with our cameras. Not saying a word, just listening. And all we hear is wildlife. And at the waterholes, you see the elephants come, the rhinos come, and then all the elk and all the aurochs all day long. And you're just like, wow. And then all of a sudden, at the end of the day, you're sitting there and there's grass there. And all of a sudden, you hear, and all of a sudden, a foot goes up. And it's a big cat. And all of a sudden, there's another one and another one. There's 10 lions that were 5 feet away from us. We couldn't see them. And just see them wake up to, you know, for dinner. At that point, it was just like, okay. It was like, wow. I came back to New York after 2 weeks, amazing weeks, and I got back to my job for 12 years. And I looked around, opened my email. It was 5,000 unanswered emails. And I was like, oh, I hate this place. I don't want to be here. God, I hate this place. At the end of the day, I met HR, and they laid me off and a couple other people. Well, be careful what you ask for. And what happened was this, I was like, oh, I would not allow them to take what the great thing happened to me, this great adventure. I kept it, I bottled it, and it was in me. The first thing I did was I went to where my friend was, dear friend for a long time, to his job, didn't tell him, I just wanted to see him because he had cancer, he's diagnosed with cancer, and I just wanted to see how he did. Then I called my sponsor, and after 12 wells, he said, well, it sounds like you're going to a lot of meetings, and laughed. And what happened was I found a new home group and a bunch of new friends. And then I got a big severance package. And what happened was I got some money back, too. I went back to Africa for a couple more weeks. You know. And what happened a couple months later, I got a couple of opportunities, and I have the job I have now. God takes care of me. I just have to stay out of the way. And I wish every single one of you happiness that I have found. And all you have to do is just show up and just be of service. Not to man, but to God. So thank you very much for listening.